Africa Live. Saying is, ain't nobody gonna do this for us but us. Talk about a Barack Obama. Don't even talk to me about Barack Obama. Let's talk about Marcus Garvey. You know what I'm saying? The question ain't whether we vote for white power and white face or white power and black face. The question is whether we will be an independent people or whether we remain colonized and oppressed until we are wiped out. This is African internationalism in action, y'all. Y'all need to get up on this. When we say we have to have power in our own hands, here we're talking about the African working class. But what we can do is to have an organized capacity of the African workers in alliance with the poor peasants who takes state power for itself. Then we can begin to say we got justice in our own hands.
Africa Live.
Just raise up these incredible African leaders that we've had. It's critical that as African people we strive to be like them. I'm talking about the Marcus Garveys. I'm talking about the Fannie Lou Hamers. I'm talking about the Malcolm X's, the Kwame Nkrumahs, and today we have Omali Eshetela.
Brothers and sisters, Africans at home and abroad, welcome to Africa Live.
Welcome to Africa Live here on WhoRadio.com. I'm your host, Nyabinga Zimbabwe, and we have in the studio with us Omali Eshetela, the chairman of the African Socialist International, and Penny Hess, the chairwoman of the African People's Solidarity Committee. We're going to have some discussion today about the economic crisis happening in the world, economic crisis of imperialism, and some more news about Obama's cabinet. We're going to start off today though by playing just a couple of clips for you. One is. Is a clip that I'm sure many of you are familiar with around a man in Iraq, a journalist, having thrown his shoes at U.S. President George W. Bush. So we're going to play that and follow that with a clip of Vice President of the U.S., Dick Cheney, speaking about defending their ability to torture people in the world. So this is a clip of Bush in the shoes.
one of the television correspondents at this news conference, in which the president is there on an unannounced visit, part of the ceremonial signing of the agreement, and you see it there, one right after the other. One of the journalists jumps up, throwing the shoes at the president. Let's listen in. And we have been looking at video that just arrived here a few moments ago. Video of a news conference with President Bush and Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki as they talked about their signing of this agreement, the Status of Forces Agreement and Strategic Agreement. Let's listen in to the reaction. Amazing. You said the journalist there. We are getting reports that he is from.
That was the first clip. You know, it's funny. They oftentimes you hear about George Bush putting his foot in his mouth, but this is just a bit different. and here's the second clip of Vice President of the U.S. Dick Cheney.
Did you authorize the tactics that were used against Khalid Sheikh Mohammed?
I was aware of the program, certainly, and involved in helping get the process cleared. That is, the agency, in effect, came in and wanted to know what they could and couldn't do. And they talked to me as well as others to explain what they wanted to do, and I supported it. There was a period of time there 3 or 4 years ago when about half of everything we knew about al-Qaeda came from that one source. So it's been a remarkably successful effort. I think the results speak for themselves.
In hindsight, do you think any of those tactics that were used against Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and others went too far?
I don't.
And on KSM, one of those tactics, of course, widely reported was waterboarding, and that seems to be a tactic we no longer use. Even that, you think, was appropriate?
I do.
What do you say to those that say you've changed?
Well, the way I think of it in terms of whether or not I changed, I think a prime motivation for me in much of what I've done was 9/11. And have I changed? Well, not in the sense that I've gone through some, you know, fundamental psychological transition here, but I have been, since that day, focused very much upon what we needed to do to defend the nation. And I think the policies we've recommended, the programs that we've undertaken, have been good programs. I think those have been sound decisions. And if that's what they mean by saying I changed, I'm guilty.
Whoa. So those are the two clips. We wanted to play those. It's not necessarily, well, not directly related to the economic crisis, but thought that was some interesting clips. Chairman Penny, would anybody like to comment on any of either of these clips?
Well, Uhuru, well, first of all, I know that the Bush being hit by the shoes clip is playing. It's all over YouTube. It's all over the world. And there's many different versions with different kind of music behind it and different things that, you know, people are enjoying it. It's having huge, huge number of people viewing it. And also the man that pitched the shoes is a hero throughout much of the world. There have been demonstrations in support of him in many, many countries. And he represents the world feeling not just against Bush, but against U.S. imperialism and what it represents. In terms of the Cheney quote, I was wondering if the chairman felt like saying anything, because I know that, Chairman, you have raised issues, or, you know, you've raised the question that it's not really, the issue isn't really torture. The issue is the right of people to self-determination and not to be invaded by the U.S. and that, you know, the U.S. had no, the war and parasitic capitalism is the crime. So I don't know if you wanted to say something about that.
It is true that most of the liberals, and not just liberals, others in this country and many people in the world would have the issue revolve around whether or not torture was used, whether or not two or three soldiers were guilty of massacring somebody, or whether or not some of the mercenaries, the corporate mercenaries like Blackwater, committed some kind of offense, slaughtered people as they have been accused of having done. And of course, the torture happened and the massacres did happen. But the way these questions are dealt with, they isolate these questions and make them the crimes as opposed to the actual attack, the invasions, the assault on people's right for self-determination, the colonial occupation. If, in fact, the problem or the crime is Cheney's authorization of torture or Blackwater's commission of some exemplary offense or some soldiers who committed what they call some kind of massacre, then the ability to hold these issues up as extraordinary legitimizes the aggression that's been made against the Iraqi people overall. It legitimizes the fact that they've taken away the people's right to self-determination. Even the guy who was goaltending for Bush when shoes were being thrown from him at him, the guy Maliki, who was attempting to block the shoes to keep them from hitting Bush, I mean, is somebody who was installed by the Bush regime, by U.S. imperialism, proper. So, you know, yeah, Cheney did it. He's a murderer. He's a thug. And the Blackwater crew are murderous thugs. They're corporate mercenaries. And the U.S. troops who carry out all offensive, every round fired, every attack made on an Iraqi village or community, et cetera, in the final analysis is offense. In fact, the only thing that I can agree with that Cheney said in that little clip was a portion where he says, I'm guilty. And in fact, you know, that's the major offense is the imperialism itself, the imperialist aggression, and not some offense that somebody made while carrying out an imperialist policy for the United States or for Europe and trying to maintain this social system that's existing now.
Right on. Well, I want to, Penny, go
ahead. I just wanted to say one other thing. Thank you for that, Chairman. I really unite with that. And also, I just wanted to mention in terms of the clip about Bush, did anybody else notice, I'm sure you did, how bad his security was? I thought that was really interesting because he, first of all, the guy got two shoes out.
Yeah.
And secondly, they did eventually tackle the guy down, but nobody ever came up to surround Bush or protect him. And I just thought that was interesting and a symbol for, you know, analogous for the vulnerability of imperialism right now. They're so arrogant, they think that nothing like that's going to happen to them. And yet the people around the world are resisting and fighting back.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I think the other thing you see, they didn't even come out to the second shoe. You didn't even see security come out from the back somewhere, right. You know, to the second shoe. And I agree. I think it's an indication of the growing ineptitude of imperialism and the fact that this system is on its way out. It's not even the state isn't even as capable as it has been in the past. And some would even argue that, you know, that is really just showing the paper tiger.
Well, I think another interesting thing about it was the news report that I saw where the guy threw the shoes at Bush, the reporter tried to cover up for the inadequate security. The reporters, the persons who were reporting on it, and they were saying things like, oh, he was really in any real danger, because if he was in real danger, the security would have rushed him out of the room. Well, you know, they didn't know what kind of dangers. The flying objects hurtling across the room, right. and the puppet president of prime minister or whatever he is of Iraq trying to block these hurtling objects. So it seems that this guy thought there was some kind of danger. And I do think it's true that not only was there you know, no security. I mean, in the most secure place in Iraq, the only place mm-hmm. where these guys can even walk around.
Yes.
The only place where the presidents and the government can even pretend mm-hmm. to function right. because they've built this bunker, you know, like yes. in the middle of Baghdad. And even with that, you know, this, which makes the assumption of extreme security consciousness, even with that, the guy gets two shoes. But here's the thing, that you have this imperial power. This guy bringing on George, you know, like, you know, victory is ours, mm-hmm. George, you know, the strutting more cojones than anybody, George, you know. This guy, this imperialism, on the, you know, the last meaningful act that he's involved in as the head of the nominal head of the empire, he's ducking shoes. I mean, that's an incredible right. statement right. about where we are and where imperialism is and what it is that the imperialists are trying to remedy with the advent of this Obama agenda that they've imposed on the rest of us. It's an interesting state that the imperialists find themselves in, and I would suggest that while Obama has a pretty good jump shot, I'm told, in basketball, he needs to start learning how to duck too.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Before moving on, I just want to point out also that the journalist who threw the shoes was saying, you know, that this is a farewell for this is for the widows and the children of Iraq, you know, and you know, so I just thought it was important to point that out too.
You dog.
Yes.
You dog. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to invite those of you who are out there listening to participate in the discussion that we're having today. You can do so by calling in or emailing in. You can call the U.S. number, which is 727-565-1599. That's country code 001. You can call the U.K. number, which is 020-8133-6629. And that's country code 44. Or you can call us through Skype for free anywhere in the African world. Our Skype ID is Uhuru Radio, and that's all one word, all lowercase. Or you can email us at dj@uhururadio.com.
I wanted to make just one other comment on this question of torture. Because the way this issue is handled also presupposes that torture is something unusual in the arsenal of U.S. imperialism. Mm-hmm. And for African people, we have to be really ensconced in self-loathing to buy that argument, to not be able to recognize the torture that we have lived with all our lives. And I just got a letter a few days ago from a comrade who, when I first knew him as a young man who was a member of JOMO, the Junta of Militant Organizations, an organization of revolutionary young people that I led in the 1960s, who's been locked up now for more than 40 years on a murder charge. And, you know, he was just commenting in the letter that me, you know, coming here at 20-some years old on a murder charge, and I've never killed anything larger than a rabbit. And, of course, the reason he's been in prison all this time is because he was with JOMO. He was a revolutionary, a part of a revolutionary organization. And the only one, and there were others who went to prison with him. And, in fact, a murder did get committed that resulted in his being imprisoned, but he had nothing to do with it. And other people are walking the street because they were able to toe the line while in prison. And he went in prison, you know, extraordinarily angry, you know, like, why am I here? I haven't killed anybody. And, you know, he was a part of the movement. And you talk about a government that without the, you know, with the blink of an eye, locks up young African men in particular, you know, men in their teens and in their 20s for 50, you know, 60 years without, you know, this is just extraordinary. Here are the colonial subjects, the people who were brought here as slaves who've never had any kind of break at all, who from whom America and European imperialism have stolen everything, stripped of everything, and leave them so few options that sometimes they may be formally guilty of crimes. But here you got a fat white guy like Cheney, who can set policies wiping out whole countries, killing people's children, having fools like the people who live in this country go and fight and kill and die for them. He pleads guilty to having changed. I say you haven't changed. Imperialism is just as it has always been, and yet these young Africans are condemned, and not just condemned. You got a person like Obama, who has a condition for even being acceptable by the vast sector of the North American population that elected him, has to deny these African people who are treated so badly, and has to cover up the kinds of crimes that imperialism, United States imperialism, the American government, white people in general, have committed against African people. So this notion of torture, I think we have to really struggle to help people understand that there's nothing peculiar about the notion of torture, that if somebody is being tortured in some camp that was set up by the U.S. government, that they practice first on African people here, that they practice first on the so-called Indians here, and that they've got a, you know, several hundred years of experience and history of doing this, and that if we are to talk about the guilt of the United States in committing torture, then at minimum we should go back to Louisiana. We should at minimum go back to New Orleans and talk about the members of the Black Liberation Army who, when they were captured, had electrical devices stuck to their testicles and forced to confess. We should at least go to Chicago to where John Birch in Barack Obama's district was responsible for terrorizing and brutalizing and killing and forcing confessions that resulted in people even, you know, getting life or sentences and even worse. So there's a way that we look at this torture question that what we actually do is end up apologizing for imperialism. We treat it like it's peculiar. We treat it like the real issue is the act that the warmonger carries out while implementing a policy that's designed to keep a people from ever being free and to take and steal their resources. There's something wrong with that, and we need to help people understand things better than that.
So we're going to take a break here, and we're going to come back with more discussion and talk a bit about the crisis of the parasitic imperialist economy. So stay tuned right here on WhoRadio.com.
If you want cook soup, now what are you going to eat?
Fela Kuti, Water No Get Enemy, one of my favorites. You're listening to Africa Live on uhururadio.com. I'm your host, Nyabinga Zimbabwe, and we have in the studio with us Omalia Shatella, the chairman of the African People's Socialist Party, and Penny Hess, the chairwoman of the African People's Solidarity Committee. I'm getting a bit tongue-tied today, but we're going to keep it moving. I want to invite those of you out there listening to participate in the discussion that we're having today. You can call in or you can email in. You can call in the U.S. number, which is 727-565-1599. That's country code 001. Or you can call in the U.K. number, which is 020-8133-6629. And that's country code 44. Or you can call us through Skype. For free, anywhere in the African world, our Skype ID is Uhuru Radio, and that's all one word, all lowercase. Or email us at dj@uhururadio.com. We're going to talk a bit about economics, the economic situation, and particularly we're going to talk a bit about Barack Obama's economic plan. Penny.
Uhuru. First of all, I would just like to really express my unity with a very moving information and analysis about in the previous sector about the question of torture and what that really means, and that was powerful, Chairman. To say to reiterate that I'm a member of the African People's Solidarity Committee, and that's the organization of white people that work under the leadership of the African People's Socialist Party. We work in the white communities, and the whole question of resources, the question of this capitalism being a parasite is key to the question of winning white people's support and solidarity for the movement for African liberation. It's something that we as white people wouldn't just ordinarily come to the kind of analysis that we get on the show, but because the party's theory of African internationalism is a theory, it's a way of seeing the world, it's a world view, that all of us can embrace it, and therefore we can begin to see things as they really are, because nothing, there's nothing being more obfuscated today than the question of the economy. And right now, you hardly read anything about it because it's Christmas and they want everybody to get out there and spend money. But the truth is, like the chairman's saying, that there's no benign capitalism. It's born on death and slavery and torture and murder and stealing the resources, destroying people's identities and culture and history, and just taking it all for the benefit of white people. So that's how it's born and that's how it's maintained. So I wanted to talk about Obama's recovery plan that he's been talking about this week, his so-called economic recovery, because there's no good way that that's going to happen.
I want to just intervene just a minute, because I agree with what you've just said. And while in terms of how we generally articulate our understanding of the political economy of the U.S. and the world, we wouldn't normally say that this happens for the benefit of white people. And there are those who would say, no, it's not for the benefit of white people, because the white people are getting screwed too. Mm-hmm. It's for the benefit of the capitalists, mm-hmm. of the, you know, those at the top 1%, who alone in the United mm-hmm. States has more resources than the bottom 90%, right. so to speak. So how do you deal with that? I think it's important to yeah. clear that up, because, you know, our objective mm-hmm. obviously is not to run around alienating
right.
everybody who could be on the side of the revolution.
Exactly.
But it is absolutely necessary at the same time to free them up, free their consciousness so that they can participate in the revolution. Because otherwise, it seems to me that we end up doing exactly what Obama does, mm-hmm. that allows white people an opportunity to unite, but to unite with America, as opposed to being able to unite with victims of America and victim. Yeah, so I'm not going to pursue it. I just wonder if you would just deal with that.
Yeah, I mean, that is really an excellent, you know, point. And something that I feel like the African People Solidarity Committee has had to deal with since we could really grasp this theory, but in particular today, like you're saying, because you know, Chairman, I mean, as your theory lays out, capitalism was born on this enslavement, the genocide, the colonization of the vast majority of the peoples of the world, and it benefits the capitalist class, but it created a pedestal on which the entire white population sits. And it doesn't mean that all white people are equal in that. We're not all that capitalist class. Very few people are, as you say. But it has enabled the entire white population to have the ideology of the ruling class, generally speaking, and to actually have opportunities and even the prosperity at the expense of people at the world around the world. And that is white power. That is white nationalism. But it also means that we, as white people, have resolved our contradictions with the ruling class at the expense of African and other peoples. But that doesn't have to be that way. And I think that the thing that it shows is that today, that the capitalist class, because people around the world are struggling for control of their resources, because people are not accepting U.S. imperialism just in the same old way, and are fighting back and resisting, that and because resources are more and more scarce for various reasons, because U.S. has plundered them as well, that the capitalist class is trying to save its own skin because imperialism is on the decline. And that they're like, okay, you know, we'll screw you, the rest of you white people too, in a certain way.
Well, the thing is, too, that when we talk about capitalism, we talk about a social system. And when you talk about a social system, you're not just talking about a social system comprised of an aggregate number of individuals. So, you know, you might have some poor white people, relatively speaking, to other white people. But the fact is that the white people enjoy social wealth, mm-hmm. and Africans enjoy social poverty.
Right.
That as a group, white people are wealthier despite the differences that exist between them, because for the oppressed African, it doesn't matter That difference doesn't matter, because if all the wealth that comes to white, the white world comes as a consequence of slavery and expropriation of value from the rest of us, then we're not debating the question that some of you got a little less than the others of you from what you stole from us. The question is that all the wealth is social wealth that's produced social poverty. Just like there may be one or two Africans who do well, but the fact that doesn't negate the fact that Africans as a whole enjoy social poverty. So I think that's what's so really important for us to understand. And the fact is that as the crisis deepens, then the tendency is for the imperialists to try to increase the amount of value that comes from the oppressed peoples around the world. And that it becomes the responsibility of white people also to exorcise this demon in their midst, this white ruling class, and to unite with the vast majority of the peoples of the world and fight for a different kind of world where everybody can enjoy social wealth and where we can extricate ourselves from the grasp and grip of the capitalists. And the problem is the ideological thing that you just mentioned in part, but also the wealth, the value, is that the majority of white people are ideologically ensconced, are ideologically united with the white ruling class by whiteness, by the philosophy of whiteness, which has become a part of the identity of the European nation. So I'm not going to pursue it any longer, but I just really think it's important.
I think it is extremely important, and I think it is something that we need to keep discussing, because it's so clear, because the question is, and it's just as it's been in every economic crisis inside of the United States in history, is that white people don't fight the ruling class. They're going to attack Africans. Yeah. They're going to attack Mexicans. You can already see the question of, quote, immigrants right now, and the question of prisons, the question of just, you know, get out of the inner cities, they're saying, you know, these people, these, what do you call them, survivalists and stuff, and all that kind of thing, and which is a growing sector of the white population. And it's, you know, it's whether it's going to be white war for control of what white people consider our entitlement, which is the resources of the world, or whether you're, like you're saying, Chairman, it's going to be really in solidarity in creating a new world that, you know, that they can't, imperialism can't solve it. They can't do it. They're just deepening, going deeper into the mire, putting out the fires, but it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And I think this is the key discussion that you're talking about. So just to say that in terms of Obama's recovery plan, but again, Obama, I was reading in the Washington Post today, by the way, that 68% of the United States are optimistic about Obama's presidency solving problems. And 86%, that's 68% of the United States population as a whole, and 86% of Democrats are optimistic that Obama can solve the problems on a myriad of fronts. And that includes 77% believe that Obama will improve U.S. image abroad, 68% believe that he will improve health care, 67% that he will reduce global warming, and 64% believe that he will end the war in Iraq, which is, you're smiling, Chairman, and right, because first of all,
they're going to do it with the same guys.
The same guys who created it, and and first of all, half of this stuff isn't even things that Obama's promised, so it's not likely to happen. But
one thing's not on the list is set the Negroes free.
Oh, exactly.
0%.
So this is what in the New York Times today it's saying, that Obama is expanding now as they're seeing how bad the economy is. And I want to talk about some of those indicators a little bit later. But they're saying that he's expanded. They met last night or something. And, you know, they're sitting around smoking cigarettes.
Christmas past.
Exactly.
The ghost of Christmas past.
Right. And Christmas future. saying that they had to reconsider their plan. And Now they're going to create 3 million jobs in the next 2 years, up from the goal of 2.5 million jobs.
Oh, boy.
But
add another half
million. Right, here and there. But as even the New York Times says, even Mr. Obama's most ambitious goal would not fully offset as many as 4 million jobs that will be lost next year. That's in addition to the 4.4 million jobs that were lost this year, not counting all the Africans in prison and all the people not looking for jobs because they've been unemployed for so long. So, you know, it's that is ridiculous. And when you talk about Obama's cabinet, you're talking about, like the chairman said, the people who created this. There's nothing new in it. There's not even a new thought. There's not even somebody who thinks outside the box or anything like that within the context of capitalism, even.
Yeah.
Obama is talking about his economic recovery plan will use $800 billion. First of all, what? I mean, the U.S. just spent $8.5 trillion, and that is, if you don't believe me on that, look at sfgate.com because they have it itemized. That's the San Francisco Chronicle's website. They have it itemized, the $8.5 trillion that the U.S. has expended in 2008 or promised, and they've spent half of it. So, you know, that's ridiculous. But Obama says he's going to rebuild infrastructure. He's going to build a, quote, green economy. He's you know, going to do the kinds of things that Franklin Roosevelt did to jumpstart the economy, he says. But, I mean, the question is, first of all, how can you jumpstart an economy that is 72% consumerism? In other words, it's blatant, raw parasitism. It's parasitism that requires African and oppressed people around the world to be living, subsisting on pennies a day at the expense of their resources, and African people in this country to be in prison, to be in dire poverty, to be shot down by the police, to have martial law that white people were afraid of is going to be happening all over and is, but it's already been happening in the African community. So to say that you're going to jumpstart an economy that's based on consumerism, does that make sense? I mean, I'm not an economist, Chairman, but that doesn't make sense to me in any way, you know, because first of all the jobs he's talking about are limited time. They're not creating an infrastructure of factories. And I just want to make a sideline point on that, because some of the left economists are saying, well, what we need is to bring the factories back to the United States, because the only thing, they say, that creates wealth is manufacturing, that nothing else creates wealth, because what you do with manufacturing is you take a few cents worth of resources and you produce it into a computer. Like, you take these minerals, $5 worth of minerals, and make a $1,000 computer. But the fact is, that's not going to work because people all over are struggling for the resources, struggling for control of it.
But the other thing is that the reason the minerals cost $5 is because the imperialists set the terms for the price.
Yeah.
So the coltan coming from Congo is set at this extraordinarily low price because they control the world economy. And the computer made with the coltan sold back to the Congo costs 15, 25, 100 yeah. times more than what it did. So as long as they can control the prices of things like that, then they can, you know, they're the ones who determine value in that artificial kind of way. So I think that's one of the things that's... The other thing is that I think that it's really interesting that they use the Roosevelt comparison when they talk about Obama, because there is some validity to what Obama would like to do with this program. And it's not just something that they would like to do. It's almost necessary, because Roosevelt's program was an anti-revolutionary program. It was a program that was designed to try to stave off revolution, to keep workers and particular workers, you know, like from turning this thing right side up. And so he did these programs of getting a job so the worker can get a job, as opposed to ascending to the new ruling class and get a better job as a worker. I mean, or a different job or something to that effect. Part of what they talk about when they mention jumpstarting the economy, I think, is something that they might refer to as a kind of echo or what do they call it, like a green economy, you know, assuming that, you know, this guy Van Jones, who is now, I heard even this guy Friedman, you know Friedman, the world is flat? No, not Milton Friedman, the guy who writes, I think, for the Washington Post and who has written, Yeah, I heard him quoting Van Jones, you know, our Van Jones, right? Yeah. Who has written some book, you know, like about, you know, how to change this into a green economy.
Yeah.
And that would be, you know, this, you know, get rid of the primary factor being consumerism. The fact is, here's the dilemma. You touch on the dilemma of consumerism is a dilemma. And a consumer economy is a credit economy. I mean, that's what it has to be. It has to be essentially a credit economy.
Yes.
And the thing about it is that that is the profound contradiction that they are confronted with in terms of trying to make the economy better. They have to find a way to make people capable of spending on the one hand, but on the other hand, there's a greater reluctance on people to spend in part because they ain't got no money and increasingly because they no longer believe in the money.
Right.
You know, which is a profoundly important, you know, aspect of it.
Absolutely.
Right?
And I would like to talk about that more because in the next part. But I do want to read this
first.
And because this is Obama's real economic plan.
Tell us about it.
In yesterday's St. Petersburg Times, it says the little article, more than 100,000 people in state prisons. That's Florida prisons. Florida's prison population topped 100,000 for the first time Thursday, making it third in line after California and Texas. To prepare for more prisoners, the state has purchased and begun setting up tents to house inmates, though none are being used. Department of Corrections Secretary Walter McNeil told lawmakers this month that prisoner growth shows no signs of stopping. The state will need to build 19 prisons in the next 5 years if nothing is done to slow the growth, he said. He estimated the cost of $1.9 billion, nearly equal to the department's annual budget. Well, I looked up how many prisons are there in Florida. There's 137. So 19 is like, what, 12% increase? I mean, this is outrageous. What? There's already 1 in 8 African men in prison, young African men in prison, and they're going to build 19 new prisons. That's economic stimulus, and that's happening everywhere. They're talking about states are bankrupt, cities are bankrupt. Well, cities are bankrupt all over California and other places too because the police budget, or what they call public safety, is in some cities 87% of the budget. And this is what they're saying. And I've seen things that say that prison guards make like $30,000-$40,000. No, prison guards make six figures, and often police do too, with overtime and all kinds of things that they do. And I know in different cities like Vallejo, California, that's bankrupt, I think the police were making close to $100,000 a year, and they get perks, obviously. They're part of the drug trade, as everybody knows. And, you know, I mean, this is the economic stimulus that they're talking about. And I feel that you know, again, white people have white pedestal, sitting on the pedestal, white social wealth has been built on prisons in this period, you know, more than any other factor. And that if we're going to be progressive, if we're going to want to see a solution, the answer isn't, you know, further concentration camps and torture dens of African people, which is never talked about. Like you're saying, the people, the guards at Abu Ghraib were guards in U.S. prisons against Africans. And this is, you know, I just think that this is what Obama represents. He hasn't made one statement against the mass imprisonment of African people. I haven't seen him address that, and I follow his stuff pretty closely. And his Attorney General, Eric Holder, an African, one of the three Africans that he's picked on his, you know, many, many, many people cabinet, it supports it, wants the mandatory minimums. And we have to understand that Wall Street is tied into this too, into the prison economy, into the private prisons. Private prisons trade on Wall Street. They go up and down with the stock market. And the thing that keeps their stock up is three strikes, you're out, mandatory minimums, and statements like this that are saying, we're going to keep filling those prisons and making them an economic profit-making machine for the next 5 years, next 10 years, indefinitely. So we have a situation where the housing bubble crashed at the expense of African people, where the dot-com bubble crashed. But the prison bubble is going strong, and nobody talks about it. This is part of the parasitism today, and we have to recognize that this is what Obama stands for.
I think that what we're talking about is what imperialism stands for. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the critical thing, because the imperialism didn't change its nature because they put a Negro in front of the damn thing. And the fact is, it's clearly camouflage. What Obama represents is camouflage. And, you know, we keep talking about Obama, and some people can be upset about it because you didn't say the same things about Clinton, or you didn't say this about McCain, etc. And the reality is that Obama is their solution to camouflage imperialism. Clinton wasn't tricking Africans except a few stupid Negro feminists. McCain wasn't tricking Africans, etc. But this guy has tricked them all. The Negro feminists, the reactionary Negroes, the so-called left-wing and revolutionary Negroes, all are on board with imperialism. And that's what they're on board with, imperialism. When they step there with Obama, they step with imperialism, even if they do it while jumpsuiting. And I think that's the critical question. It's not just a matter of having a throwdown on Obama, you know, because he's obviously a very clever, well-spoken person, but he is one of the best tools imperialism has created in a long time. But I'm telling you, it's too late. And the thing is that revolution is the only solution, and no matter what anybody else does, our community, African people here and around the world, are suffering from a lack of revolutionary leadership. And my responsibility, responsibility of the African People's Socialist Party, the responsibility of the African Socialist International, is to put revolutionary organization down on the ground, to take revolutionary analysis, to take revolutionary ideology, to help people understand that imperialism does not represent a solution no matter how it presents itself to us, and that it must be ripped out. It's like a cancer on the body of humanity, and it must be destroyed if people are ever to be free. That has to be our stance. And, you know, like even people in our own movement and party were reluctant to go out and deal with the Obama phenomenon because Negroes liked him too much to say anything about it. That's what our responsibility is to tell the truth at the time when there's a whole wave of lies and distortion that's out there. Nobody needs a revolutionary when everybody knows the revolution has to be made, when everybody knows the path of the direction. You don't need a revolutionary for that. You need revolutionaries at exactly and precisely the times when there's nothing, when there's much confusion, and when the bourgeoisie, when the imperialists have succeeded in blindfolding and confusing masses of people, and we have to take up the call. We have to take up our responsibility and build a revolutionary response.
Uhuru. We're going to take a break here. You're listening to Africa Live on uhururadio.com, and when we come back, take some of your questions and have some more discussion here on uhururadio.com. The terror commenced with slavery like Maryland's, when we was taken from Africa, called Americans. I worked all day and slept in the slave quarters. I used to be the overseer, now the Jake's on us. We still live as slaves, trapped in the same borders. Only difference now, we go to work with 8 quarters on the train, telling ourselves to maintain on our way to misery. Coming home to the same bullshit. The pigs walk the block with 4 clips, trying to send us to the place preachers talk about a pulpit. Who you with, someone set you plain. Don't be from the raw hood, that could get you banged on the rail. That shit got many brothers blasted. It got caught on the wrong side of Mother Gaston. The state gave us crack to make the people struggle backwards, to make sure war against the state was unimagined. Part of the war they was making on the masses, to make sure the black population stayed trapped in the state by the state. The state carry weight in and out of state. My fam take it day by the day. That's how it is when you're trapped by the states. Trapped in the states by the state. My combat got snatched by the jakes. Africans take it day by the day. That's how it is when you're trapped by the states.
On the border of Guinea and Sierra Leone, neo-colonial soldiers is heavily armed to keep the masses of the Africans separate from our resources getting ripped off by these imperialist hogs. It's so hot it truly could fall till we control the fruits of our soil. We in pursuit of our gold, we end up traveling to North America in pursuit of resources that we were severed from. But if you're looking for a better life, forget it done. You came to the terror dome when niggas getting hung. Matter of fact, we would leave if we had consciousness, but the white ruling class control the politics. They're telling us to integrate into the populace and be a good house nigga like Obama is. But the fact is, Africans is held captive from a land we was fractured.
Trapped in the state by the state. The state carry weight in and out of state. Our fam take it day by the day. That's how it is when you're trapped by the states. Trapped in the states by the state. My combat got snatched by the jits. Africans take it day by the day. That's how it is when you're trapped by the state.
We had war with house niggas and police. Winters with no heat. Junk food and corner stores. Levers with no teeth. Don't fuck with no beef. Tapeworms will take what you earn. Even looking like you don't eat. With all the bullshit going on in my community, it make me wonder what more these crackers could try to do to me. Anything that you could think of, they throw me. From the slum lords to the local fiends, we don't sleep. The shots ring out regularly in the middle of the night. Clap back or don't eat. It's that simple. It's not a riddle. The only issue, who to put these slugs into? Who responsible for the bullshit we going through? We say the state got us trapped in this misery, living in the ghetto. Some say we in prison in the mental. I disagree. We held hostage militarily.
Trapped in the state by the state. The state carry weight in and out of state. Our fam take it day by the day. That's how it is when you're trapped by the states. Trapped in the states by the state. My combat got snatched by the jits. Africans take it day by the day. That's how it is when you're trapped by the states.
Welcome back to WhoRadio.com. This is the show Africa Live, and I'm your host, Nibinga Zimbabwe, in here with Omalia Shetela, the chairman of the African People's Socialist Party, and Penny Hess, the chairwoman of the African People's Solidarity Committee. We want to take a couple of questions. The first is from, it came to us online. It says, Uhuru, when the 2008 presidential fake selection anesthesia wears off and reality hits the fan concerning the global plight of African people sets in, will Barack Obama now become the sacrificial lamb and be used as a scapegoat and perhaps meet the same fate as Ron Brown because he knows too much? Hotep Mikhaili Shange.
I don't think that that's the going to be the case. I think there's a big difference in a Ron Brown and a Barack Obama in terms of how the imperialists intend to employ them. For one thing, I think a Barack Obama was absolutely necessary for imperialism at this time in history, because not only Africans but other peoples around the world have peeped the white card, and people are fighting against imperialism in many ways, not necessarily seeing it as this white thing, this white power that's being attacking us. And while people like Ron Brown were helpful, Jesse Jackson was helpful. You know, he was Clinton's representative in Africa. He was helpful in trying to disguise it. They've never had to go so far as to actually have a nominal head of the thing. And even Ron Brown and Jesse Jackson did not have the responsibility of denouncing like the aspirations and African people and actually clouding the history of U.S. imperialism as what it means to the peoples of the world. Obama's entirely different. He's entirely different. Not that neocolonialism is different. It was neocolonialism, whether it was Jackson, whether it was Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell, Brown, who you just mentioned. But Obama is different in the sense that he is somebody who is absolutely necessary for imperialism to disguise the whole thing now. It's not just needing to find a way to get into a particular place, but for the overall economy. When Brown was there, you had a situation where they had something called the Group of Seven. Subsequent to that time, you see in growing numbers of countries that have been in the column of the oppressed and colonial peoples who are now a part of this group that they are trying to make a party to the crimes of imperialism to draw them into the company. This is a way that white power tries to disguise itself too in many ways, and also tries to create allies from among the oppressed people as imperialism goes about continuing its looting. So now the group of 20 includes countries like Brazil, South Africa, China, India, etc. my point is that the whole world has changed. And so I don't think, Obama could be a scapegoat, but I think he would be different from what we're looking at in terms of Ron Brown, because the real issue that I think is inherent in your question when you talk about scapegoat is the assumption that it's not going to work. And the reality is that it is not going to work. But the other thing about scapegoat, too, it seems to make the assumption that he's a patsy. He's somebody who is not a part of the plot. He's somebody who is just being used independent, perhaps of his knowledge of the game, or perhaps of a willingness to participate and become a part of the group. Obama is a part of the crew. He has been incorporated into the crew for the purpose of carrying out the mission that he's on. So I agree that it's not going to work, which seems to be a part of the premise of your question. I don't think he's the same as a Ron Brown or some of the others who I've just suggested. And they're not just Ron Browns, but they're even militant nationalists who have joined the attempt to cover for imperialism by covering for Obama as well. He's different. Obama is different from these guys. And we may, the next time around, they may use a Mexican, or they may use some other kind if they can get away with it, or a woman, etc. But they're trying to really disguise the hand of imperialism so it doesn't look the way it used to look. And they would prefer to use someone from among the oppressed ourselves. That's what neocolonialism is about. In terms of its political expression, they would prefer to use somebody from among the oppressed themselves. But these guys, like Obama, they are willing partners. These are not patsies. These are not somebody who've been roped into it and sort of tricked about it. And therefore, if he falls on his own sword, it won't be as a consequence of him having been tricked. He might have slipped, but it wasn't because he was tricked. Yeah.
Right on. I want to allow for questions in the studio before we move.
Uhuru, I had a question. Uhuru, I really appreciate the discussions. Really, really powerful and really informative. And I had a question. You were saying, Chairman, that about that a consumer economy is a credit economy. And I'm just trying to understand the development of parasitic, as we're seeing parasitic imperialism and capitalism going into economic crisis in a really escalated time span, trying to understand the development of it, because as I understand, like, the whole cycle and the whole process of resources, natural resources, and the creation of wealth, as I understand it, it starts off with the natural wealth, where you have like mining and agriculture primarily, you know, taking either the minerals or the agricultural product from the earth. And that is mostly, has always, since the start of capitalism, taken place primarily in Africa, Latin America, somewhat in Asia, where the people who work in that extraction of natural resources don't even get paid enough to live, and it's extreme exploitation and of their labor, so that the capitalist economy pays a tiny amount for that product, that natural resource. Then it comes into a manufactured product, you know, to create something usable and wealth out of that. And there's a period of time where a lot of that manufacture took place within the imperialist centers. Like in America, you had a lot of factories, sweatshops, whatever. And then up until, I guess, like the 50s or something, at a certain point, it got shifted where that manufacture process also was done in the formerly colonized or the neo-colonized countries of Latin America, Africa, and Asia. And the jobs and the economy of the U.S. And of the imperialist centers, and most primarily of white people, was like more higher level of parasitism, where people's jobs had to do with sitting at a computer, you know, moving resources around, whether in like insurance, banking, finance industries, the medical industry, service related stuff. And so, I mean, at least from the 50s, I guess, a high level of consumerism in terms of, you know, white people in America, because accumulating a lot of stuff, all kinds of, everything's geared around shopping. And I guess I have two questions. One, what does it mean, a consumer economy? Does that include that those jobs that people have where they're working at a desk in some kind of, you know, retail or in some kind of bureaucratic type job? Because when I think of consumer, it's like shopping or buying houses or buying cars or whatever. And then the whole credit thing with it being a credit economy, it seems like that is really escalated more recently, because wasn't there a period where people had these parasitic jobs, but they didn't necessarily have their entire life based on credit cards or their mortgages or whatever. They might have had a parasitic job and then they bought the stolen loot. I'm just not clear on that development into the crisis now, which is heavily focused on the credit issue.
I just wanted to say something on that, because it is really important to the crisis that they're in now. The parasitic capitalism is based on credit. And if you go back to the very beginning, like the chairman says, how did Columbus get his money? He had to get a loan from Queen Isabella, and she had to hawk her jewels to the pawnbroker. Because when they go into Africa and create this torture, this terror, when they go into colonialism, it requires an investment, because they're not going to get the returns until later. They're going to make an investment and they're going to make a lot of money, but not immediately. They have to borrow that money. So they had to borrow the money to begin with. And if you look at the, you know, the whole thing, let's just look at a business model. How did the trade in African human beings work? Well, it had things like, it had shipbuilders, so they had their whole thing. It had ship owners. It had people who leased the ships, who were ship captains. Then they went to the coast of Africa, and they had the procurement teams. That would be the people who terrorized and kidnapped Africans and brought it back. That was a whole other business. Then it would be, you know, then they take the stolen, kidnap people to the Americas. Then there's the auctioneers. Then there's the retail. But all of the people borrowed money to start. They borrowed resources to start that. And, you know, that's credit. So it's based on credit. And what they're talking about right now is that, you hear this on the news, that the economic crisis is a credit crisis. That's what they keep saying. And there's something called the letter of credit. The letter of credit is when this is why the shipping, the letter of credit is not being given by any banks. And shipping has collapsed by 92% in the world right now because of this. And all of the other things have frozen. You can't get a short-term loan because the Wall Street bankers, the ruling class bankers, are not giving out credit. But the letter of credit goes back to the trade in African people. When people, you know, these slave ship owners were taking, you know, their cargo to the Americas, they had to get a letter of credit or they wouldn't offload. Right. They would rather throw the Africans into the sea and get the insurance money. They're not going to give it unless those people can get, because they were dealing with different currencies, different kinds of things. They wanted to say, I have to know I'm getting my money for this. This was my investment. And this has gone on all this time. Now, go ahead, Chairman.
No, I was just going to say that I think that it really got well developed with the Medicis, but that's Italy, right?
Yes.
Well, it's now Italy,
yes.
And around the 15th century, you know, where they really, I mean, I think that's who developed the letter of credit. It might have come from the institutions mm-hmm. created by the Medicis back then. So it's been an ongoing part of the process. I think one of the things that's happening is become a popular instrument more and more. Because you can go back, and I can remember debates, you know, in the last 35, 40 years that people were having about whether or not currency was even going to be that significant with the advent of the card, the credit card, plastic. And this is something that's been promoted for some time now. So it's not really something that just, you know, happened all of a sudden. What it might have happened is a sort of democratization of the credit thing so that people who in the past couldn't have as easy access to it, they've made the market, they've expanded the market inside this country. There's also been a debate that was really happening during the 60s about a sort of kind of international division of labor where Europe and America would essentially be the producers and then everybody else out there in the world would be, you know, like the workers of the world and stuff like that. And increasingly what we're seeing is that the production is happening, you know, out there. And then the financial system is happening in Europe and North America primarily. Even that's changing a bit, though. So when you talk, when you hear people like Mao Zedong, who, you know, talked about the revolution, the genuine revolution, is going to mean encircling the cities, you know. He's talking about, he's using, what do you call it, a metaphor for the relationship of the oppressed peoples around the world to the European and North American centers of, you know, which have sort of like the cities of the world. That's where the real struggle, that's where the real power, take that and strangle and kill off, you know, like the cities.
Yeah, just on that, I would, you know, I would say too, like you were saying, that they democratized credit, but in prior eras of the U.S., the resources were just so abundant because the trade in African people was happening, the land was being stolen. And white people, it was just like when they had diamonds that you could just pick up off the ground. I mean, the resources were just so abundant that white people could just get it by participating in the genocide. But white people still had car loans and mortgages. Mm-hmm. So white people had credit. Mm-hmm. Wait, there was credit, and white people had that. But it's expanded in these bubbles. The credit became a bottle.
And the real recent credit, and that's why you hear the blame being shifted for African people now about the housing crisis, the mortgage. We took loans that we know we couldn't afford to have. That's the so-called democratization of the here. You know, so Africans are now buying a house. And but even so, the wealth gap in this country, what is it? Something like 13 times greater amounts of wealth that in the white community than in the African community. Right. So,
and that's going to make sense.
Yeah.
I think it's really also, Sandy, you were asking about.
There's a local struggle issue happening here in the city of St. Petersburg. You may have read something about it this morning, St. Petersburg Times, the Baywalk thing.
Yes.
Because now, you know, the city, it cost about $40 million to do that thing, and the city gave up something like $12 million taxpayers' dollars to make that thing happen. And now it's proved to be, what do you call it, a white elephant? Is that what you call it when it fails like that? And so now they're saying that, they're hinting that the reason that it failed is because of, they say, rowdy teens, meaning Africans, right? They're Africans chasing, this is why it's failed, right? It was a good economy. And the truth of the matter is, there have never been a good European economy until they involve themselves with Africans. And this is why they, so in every instance, that becomes, that's the real scapegoat, brother, the brother who was talking. You know, it won't be Obama, it's going to be the rest of us who they try to use as a scapegoat. But you were going to say something, Comrade Hess.
Well, yes, I saw that, Chairman, about Baywalk, and the guy went into foreclosure after the new owner bought it from Sembler, who the movement has been in struggle with for many, and it's just so clear that everything gets blamed on African workers. That is the scapegoat, and it's really clear on that. Just to say on the question of consumerism and credit, that Clinton called it that we were switching to a service economy. So that includes what you're talking about, like the computers and everything like that. And what it means, the left calls it globalization. And African internationalism has, that's like, African internationalism would be opposed to that because the capitalism was always global. They were always going from Britain to Africa to the Caribbean to China to the opium trade and all over the world. They did that from day one. But the thing that happened was that what happened was that there was manufacturing in the United States because resources around the world were cheap. And that happened especially after the Second Imperialist War when the U.S. emerged the leader of world economy, the economy, the world capitalist economy. And that's really what got the U.S. out of the Depression of 1929, not anything that FDR did. But what happened under Clinton was where that the U.S. could no longer just make, the ruling class could no longer just make a huge profit just on cheap resources. They now needed cheap labor. And the whole sort of pedestal, the demands of white people had been to get more and more of a share of the loot. So they had to ship the factories outside of the U.S. where the workers could work for 20 cents a day and have no environmental or health care or any kind of thing like that. And so it's basically like the U.S. So they made it a kind of world economy where the U.S. sort of gets all the benefits and everybody else is sort of the industrial neighborhood of the U.S. in a certain way, or of Europe and the U.S. and white power. And a lot of white people really complained about that. Like Marxists, you know, didn't agree with that. They've been against it because they're saying that, you know, that there has to be a productive, there has to be this means of production inside the United States. But really, the Marxists have never taken into account the question of the stolen resources to begin with and stolen labor of African people. So it's not like it's really that much different. It's just what, you know, what they were hoping to do, I think, was create these bubbles where the standard of living overall of white people would go up, at least for a while. And then there would be complete unity that the U.S. had to go around the world and have the war against the Iraqi people, you know, put most Africans in prison and do all these things to maintain this. And I think that in some ways Bush was successful at doing that until it all collapsed at the end.
Well, the issue is that for this kind of economy, there has to be, when you say it's a consumer economy, you really mean it's a market economy. You know, it's the place where everything is purchased. That's why even they talk about how China can be hurt if the credit crunch, you know, keeps people from this country from being able to purchase. It's a market economy. And for a market economy, the people here have to have money, you know, to do that. And it's really interesting because all they have to have the appearance, the semblance of money or something. So credit has taken over. And even this has happened at the expense of what might ordinarily be called a working class. So the money is not coming as a consequence of in fact, there are fewer unions now. What, maybe 11% of the workers in this country, if not less, are unionized. And even when you talk about bailing out Detroit, they weren't talking about any of the conditions, you know, for the financial institutions or for the cities or states that they're making for the, you know, the workers. They say the workers are making too much money. The thing, though, is they got this contradiction where the economy is built on people being able to at least have the semblance of spending money. So it's credit and not even real money that the workers would have, you know, just a credit, the ability to keep. It's, you know, the U.S. economy, they talk about this guy, I forgot his name, is it Mazda or something like this?
Madoff.
He did, he made off. He made off with $50 billion. This is a Ponzi scheme. But the whole U.S. economy is a Ponzi scheme. The whole thing is a Ponzi scheme because it's all, you know, there is no money. I mean, so people go and they go to this, you know, the ATM and you act like you really
made something happen. You know, you do that and you go to the store and you give them a card and they say, okay, and you pass through with a receipt in your hand. No money has gone from hand to hand. So credit is the thing that keeps it going right now. And now the bubble is really being seriously challenged.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, a couple of interesting things on that. First of all, there are some, you know, I don't know if they're economists, but sort of Wall Street kind of guys who are really in struggle with what's happening and the bailouts and all that kind of thing. And not because they're progressive, but because they want some of the action. But there's this guy, his name is Chang, and I think he's a British citizen. I think he lives in London, but, you know, he's Asian. And he is writing this great stuff just on ranting and raving against China, India, Russia, and what they call the emerging economies, which of course is the colonized countries. And he's saying that, what's wrong with you guys? Don't you realize, you know, he goes, you sent too many of your people to Harvard Business School. You're inculcated with their ideas. Don't you realize the U.S. is in debt to you? You're acting like you're in debt to them. Stop playing the game. And this is where the chairman, I was talking to the chairman about this earlier in the week, and you were talking about how the dollar as the reserve currency of the world is a matter of people believing it. Yeah. And this is guys saying, all you have to do to China, India, and all these places that lend the U.S. $2.7 billion a day in U.S. Treasury bonds, and right now they're not even getting any interest for doing that.
Yeah.
He's saying all you have to do is turn that around and tell the United States government to pay back, to pay you back in your currency, and you would be doing great. Your currency would immediately inflate. The dollar would collapse. You would be in great shape. You could rebuild your economy the way you wanted to do it. But, you know, he's really targeting neocolonialism without using that. And he's saying things like, don't you remember that when Britain colonized us, it made us call it Mother England? You know?
As opposed to Mother something else.
That's right. Anyway, it's
Royal
just...
seven
it's,
words.
It's interesting. Chairman, please talk about that.
No, it is a really important discussion because there's this illusion that's what this thing about the credit, you know, economy. It's so much of it is illusion because it's not really money. It's belief that money is there. It's belief in value. Like I was saying, even when they talk about, you know, the 800 or 750 or $850 billion. It's not like somebody's going to pull up to the banks with tractor trailer loads of money and give it out. They just go to a computer and say, okay, there's something there. It's not like they even see it, you know, or anything like that. There's no bank that you can go to in this country that has any substantial amount of money at any given time. I created a crisis one junction when I went to try to when I saw what was happening, I went to take out all my little change from the bank, and it was a crisis. You should give us notice that you're coming to get it because they don't have it. So the thing is, it's belief in the system. It's belief that it's there. That is so, and increasingly, people are not believing it. And that's part of the crisis that we're looking at because, like, what has happened in the last several months, for example, where the auto industry had liquidity and suddenly it doesn't have any money? What happened? Well, the banks had it and now they no longer have it. Did you have an actual movement actual transfer of something like the several billion dollars that they're talking about, or hundreds of billions of dollars, or how many, $13 trillion that's in the mix? Did you actually have that kind of money moving? No, you didn't have that kind of money moving. It's the belief in that. It's the belief in that. It's the belief when you go to your computer and you click on your little your online account and it says such and such a thing. It's the fact that you believe that there's something there that makes the stuff work. At the point you stop believing it, and you and all the other people around you, and you say, hey, I'm going to go to the bank like I did, right? Like I did. I said, dig a hole and put it in, you know, and to go get it. That's when you see that the thing begins to crash. And that's what's happening around the world. And that's what you're talking about. You're talking about China now, you know, actually discussing whether or not it wants to continue to play this role. And even, by the way, I saw something recently, debate, perhaps it was today, on some little show. They were talking about the economy and, you know, like, and how everybody has followed the U.S. and even now. But there's a huge debate happening in places like India. They're gloating in some instances at what's happening in the United States. They say, you know, here you come, you're bullying us, you're telling us this is how we have to do, just complete, you know, like a free market economy, et cetera. And so it's the belief in the thing. It's, you know, that at the moment people stop believing it, then the thing goes into a serious state of crisis because they want to see something and they haven't seen anything, mm-hmm. and you know that's a reality. So that you know you think of it, you know I don't know how your brain works, but when they talk about the $800 billion, you know you think of mountains of money someplace. I mean I see mountains of money, but there aren't the dollars aren't there. It's in my brain, and at the moment I stop accepting that concept, then I say, hey, give me my $800 billion. They ain't got it. And even now, when they say the banks now have, they're transferring all this, giving up half of it to the banks, it's not like there's, you go to the bank vault and you go to any bank and you find that money there. But if not, they put it on the computer and they say it's there. I mean.
Well, yes, I've been reading that the number one bank is becoming the mattress. Under the mattress. Yeah, because of that. And it's true, because that's when they say that banks only have like 10%. They have in dollars, yeah. in actual dollars, 10% of all the money that people have put into the bank.
Yeah.
And then the FDIC, which is the insurance whatever to, you know, program to rescue banks, only has about 10% of all the money that's supposed to be in U.S. banks. So there isn't that money, no. like you're saying. There's not that money. And that...
there's the concept of the money.
There's the concept of the money, because if any loan is issued in the United States, that is new. That is money being printed.
Yeah.
And that's why this is driving the dollar down, because of all this. It should be far more down. It should be down much more. But the markets are being manipulated. But that's why you have to look at things like the Baltic Dry Index, which is the shipping, because that can't be manipulated. The gold, the dollar, all that is, and oil is probably being manipulated.
Yeah. We have a question from the studio audience.
Well, just follow up. Okay, so if it's all based on believing that the money is there and it's not really there, but there is some, but so then why now? I mean, the bankers know that they have to keep the false thing going. I mean, even they talk on CNN Money or MSNBC, whatever, that the big thing is a crisis of confidence, that we just have to psych ourselves that it's really okay.
Right.
And so, but it's more than just that. Then how did the confidence fail? I mean, why all of a sudden now everybody knows it's really not there and can't pretend anymore?
Go ahead.
Well, just to say on that, because what happened was they had an economy. I mean, they've always done this. It's not new, but it's really been intensified in the last 30 years, and where they call bubble economy. And that's speculation driving the prices up by lower interest rates. This is their mechanism. I'm talking about how a capitalist would describe that. And it creates all this flow of money, and rich people get really rich, and the Wall Street gets incredibly wealthy. And it, you know, quote, trickles down to a certain extent. That's what happens. It trickles down to white people, and that's what happened with the housing market. People were buying a house as an investment, and that's not something that white people did in the past. You just bought a house to live in it. You didn't buy it as an investment. So the prices were going up way beyond what people's salaries could actually pay. A house would go up to be $500,000, but a person could only you know, the person only made like $50,000 or something. So they couldn't pay for it. So this bubble crashed, just like all the bubbles crash. They come down. It happens in the Wall Street cycle. Capitalism does that. And it's a crash for a lot of reasons, because of the people taking, you know, the struggle for resources. But inside the U.S., you know, they tried to target the African and Mexican communities, and they sold the subprime mortgages, which have already pretty much all gone bad. Up to 85% of communities that had subprime mortgages, up to 85% of those houses have gone into foreclosure. I mean, that's just staggering. And that's the African community. Now they're getting ready with the second wave, which is white people's subprime, called Alt-A, and, you know, revolving, what do you call it? Where the interest rate goes up after a while. And, you know, this is set to happen in 2009. It's going to be even bigger than the subprime. But the subprime was the basis for the Ponzi scheme that they were doing in the past period. And because the banks were deregulated, they could take these mortgages, roll them up in bundles, sell them as an investment bond, which is like the equivalent of cash for an investment. They did it all around the world, and it was what they call highly leveraged, which means that they invested like 50 times more than they could actually put down, right, which you can't do. And so and they reinvested. That's the Ponzi scheme kind of thing, the pyramid scheme, where they invested on very little money, made a profit, reinvested that profit 7, 8, 10 times. That the very basis of that, the subprime mortgages went bad, in defaulted in mass. All the basis of that bond, or that what was to be that cash substitute to begin with, went bad. And that was all over the world. And so, you know, what they're talking about, what Madoff did, actually, Robert Rubin, Obama's key economic advisor, is being sued by, I think, Citicorp, by the government, for Citicorp. Yeah, for Citibank and Citigroup, I think, yeah, it's called now. And for the same thing. They all did it. And this is why they say there's a credit thing crisis, is because nobody will invest, because they don't know how bad these debts are in Wall Street, because the United States government never made them open up their books. In other words, a bailout, they've done things like that in other countries, in Sweden and places like that. But what they did was they put the bankers on trial and forced them to open up their books. So it saved capitalism. You know, if they were smart, they would do that, because then the people around the world could go, oh, okay, well, now I know what it is, and I will invest, and I know how to invest. But it's all the same people. It's Paulson. They're never going to do it. It's Rubin. It's the people who are in the government are in those positions. So, you know, this is what's happening. This is what created the crisis right now that they're in, and they don't know their way out.
You're listening to Africa Live on AhuruRadio.com, we want to, again, invite you who are listening to participate in the discussion that we're having here by calling in or emailing in. There's the U.S. number, which is 727-565-1599. That's country code 001. Or you can call the U.K. number, which is 020-8133-6629, and that's country code 44. You can call us through Skype for free anywhere in the African world. Our Skype ID is Uhuru Radio, and it's all one word, all lowercase. Or you can email us at dj@uhururadio.com.
May I say one more thing on just what I was talking about, the credit? And I just want to say that when we talk about that they speculate, Wall Street and investors, and they create bubbles, it is always at the expense of African and oppressed people around the world, always, whether it's creating the food crisis, whether it's putting Africans in prison, whether it's the drug trade, whether it's housing at the expense, you know, of African people. And when it collapses, it always creates starvation, hunger, oppression. It's not just an innocent, abstract chart. When Wall Street goes down, millions of people are suffering around the world.
And they suffer essentially for greater lengths of period, depending on whether or not they have a revolutionary capacity, where they are located, so that they can disengage themselves, their economy, from imperialism. I just wanted to say that back to the question of currency, credit, value of currency, that it has not always been that the currency was valuable only in the brains of the persons. Because there was a time when the currency would be actually backed up by gold or silver. I think it's the basis of the sterling pound, sterling silver, the basis of the pound. It was backed up by silver. In this country, gold, good as gold, you know. So there was, you know, like in theory, like amount of gold in reserve someplace that was equal to the amount of currency that was, you know, out there. So if somebody actually spent somebody, if they said, hey, in fact, doesn't the currency say something that on it that you can get?
Not anymore.
They took
now
it off.
It says Federal Reserve.
Okay. Yeah.
Document.
Right. So there was a time when there was an actual value that this actually was representative of value. Mm-hmm. Now it's a concept more than value. And the thing is that because the U.S. has for long periods of time, seemed to have been the most stable of the economies, the most successful of the imperialists. And you got to remember that that's just been since the Second Imperialist War. Before then, the world money system was located in England, which up to the Second Imperialist War controlled some actual quarter of the world's population and the world's territory. Coming out of that, the U.S. became the great power, and so it became, you know, like the quote-unquote most stable, had its hands on most of the resources of the peoples of the world. And so the dollar actually became, you know, you carry the hold on to the dollar just like it was gold, like it had that kind of value. Now you see a situation where the U.S. is clearly, and has been for a while, losing its, what do you say?
Hegemony.
Not just its hegemony, certainly, but, you know, this veneer, you know, that it has carried with it all along. And this is a safe haven. This is the place, et cetera. And, you know, and this, I'm sure it helps people to become less enamored with the U.S. as the first bank of choice when they reading that the U.S. itself is deploying, you know, military troops in Georgia to be able to contain, you know, like the people here, et cetera. That sounds like the other places where people were, the capital was fleeing from, that this kind of thing would be occurring. So increasingly, people around the world, people in this country, are losing faith in the ability. They lose faith in the U.S. They lose faith in the U.S. dollar. They lose faith in the viability of the dollar. So I think it's important to understand that. And the other thing that we have to really struggle to understand, because it's been mystified for long periods of time, is the relationship that we understand this in abstract terms, as certainly African internationalists do. But the actual relationship of the neo-colonial world, the ability of the U.S. and imperialism to control all the resources of the peoples of the world, and the stability of the imperialist economy, you know. And the thing is, like, I used to read and be a little bit disturbed. I would read Comandante Fidel. This was years ago when he was concerned about the probability of the collapse of the world economy and how calamitous that was going to be because everybody's going to be in big-time trouble, etc. But that's just one side of it. It happens, and calamity as a consequence in the short term, precisely because we don't have revolutionary organization, revolutionary capacity. Because the collapse of the world economy is the collapse of the imperialist economy. It's not just some abstract economy. It's not just, you know, it's the collapse of the imperialist economy. Here's the problem we have, that all existence occurs within the context of some kind of political economy. Even slavery, even when Africans existed in slavery, Within the slave on the plantation, we knew how we were going to eat, and even if we lived in shanties, etc., we knew where we were going to live, and we got, you know, clothes made out of grocery sacks and this kind of stuff. We knew where the clothing was going to come from within that political economy. But that's why some people were frightened. That's why Harriet Tubman had to carry a gun with her when she would escape, because some people, it got too rough. They wanted to go back because this thing that they were going into, you know, as bad as it was where they were coming from, this place they were going to, they knew nothing. There was no certainty at all about it. Right. At least with Mr. Rydolph, you know, you had something to eat, you know, where you're going to sleep. As bad as all of that may have been, that was the nature of the political economy. So we have a whole world economy. And as bad as things are in this world economy, you know, some people are frightened by the notion that this sucker might come down, might be destroyed, because at least within this world economy, you sort of know the parameters, you sort of know something about, you know, like how to move in it, and you don't have any confidence in the future, you know, a revolutionary future that the working peoples of the world would have control of, I think. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We have a question in the studio. Go ahead.
Uhuru, I want to thank the chairman and Yabinga and Penny for this incredible discussion and these understandings, and really unite with it going on YouTube so everyone around the world can benefit from it. And I just wanted to say a few things. One is around like social wealth in the white community or white world, like in the last, you know, and the whole economy being based on the expense of African and indigenous people. Like last week, there was an article in the paper about Liverpool, which really kind of, you know, whatever, from the white people's perspective, Liverpool is always, oh, the poor working class of Europe and Liverpool.
And the Beatles.
And the Beatles, right. But the Beatles who also made their money off the African community.
Yeah, sure they are.
Yeah. But, you know, like Cockney English, the real lower class, it was Liverpool. Then you read this article, and Liverpool was absolutely the center of the economy of slavery in England because it could accommodate maybe like scores of slave ships at any given time. And then they built up everything from making chains to temporary housing to the biggest shipbuilding area of the world for building slave ships. And then, of course, later on, they produced the Beatles, who were always portrayed as, oh, the young, struggling working class. But they were ripping off African culture. Mm-hmm. So brought more millions and billions into England. That's why they were knighted, because they brought so much into the English economy from ripping off African culture.
And the Rolling Stones.
And the Rolling Stones. Yeah. Disgusting. All right. But, you know, also, even personally, like my ability, when I moved 9 years ago to Florida, I went to an African man in the movement who was a car salesman in one of the places on 34th Street North. Mm-hmm. And he was blown away because I was offered from any one of the car dealers a new car with no money down, and I did not have a job. Mm-hmm. I had no job. I just said, I'm going to get a job. And he knew of an African woman who was at a job 15 years with excellent credit who could not get a credit line to buy a car. And then even my ability to buy a house here in Florida was based on being white, having a friend who made more money than what we produce, therefore could loan me $5,000 to put a down payment. So then later I could sell it and make a profit. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is part of what white people have to acknowledge about
social wealth.
Mm-hmm. And now, and even the gold, the chairman was talking about, there was gold backing the dollar at one point, or currency. Mm-hmm. There was a show on TV a few weeks ago about, oh, the belaboring 100 white engineers and ship people who spent 10 years trying to find this ship that came from California, I guess around, you know, Panama or whatever, up onto the East Coast and crashed. But it had all the gold from the gold rush of California.
So it didn't come around Panama, it went around.
I mean,
around Chile.
It went around Chile and came up to the East Coast of the U.S. and crashed, probably Cape Hatteras or something. So they finally found it after 10 years of work. How many Indians were killed? They said the rivers ran red with the blood of indigenous people during the 50 years of the gold rush. Yeah. Within the first 2 years, they probably wiped out most of the indigenous people. So here's this ship. So the gold, they finally get the gold after 10 years. and $100 million of investment or whatever, $92 million it was valued at that went to the insurance company and the people who actually retrieved it. Nothing back to Africa or the indigenous people. And now, the credit thing, like most small businesses do rely on loans to do their payroll or loans to get their goods until they sell them, as the chairman and Penny were bringing out. And like even now, we're faced with fundraisers we do, which may not happen next year because they can't get a line of credit to produce the fundraiser.
Right.
But in a way, okay, that might make me nervous for one little minute. But really, what was that fundraiser to begin with? It was African culture. They got a line of credit from banks to bring all this African culture from all around the world to the woods of Northern California to perform, in which they profited millions of dollars. So, okay, let it fold, because the real thing is building the new economy. And the chairman keeps telling us the ASI, the ASI, the Africa's resources in the hands of African people. For white people, what are we going to invest in? Jump off the ship. I have some contacts that I feel are really seeing, okay, wow, what Uhuru Move has been saying is really right. It's really right on. It's playing itself out with Obama. And some people are really nervous. They don't want to know you anymore because they want to hold on to the last threads of this, quote, hope that the imperialist economy will keep going. And we're saying, jump out.
Yeah.
Get in with us. Let's build the new economy, a revolutionary economy, not based on oppressor and oppressed.
I don't know if anybody wants to.
I just think one of the things that we're seeing today is the depth of religion in this country. And I'm not talking about the obvious kind of thing, but I'm talking about idealism, you know, which is a form of religion, you know, where, you know, the faith in things unseen, unknown, and, you know, no evidence of it. In fact, evidence can be quite contrary to what it is you're seeing. And the, really, the ability of people to say, well, you know, in the face of every bit of evidence of who Obama is, you know, to go some other place with that, and how is, that's an obvious thing, but the thing that the comrade just mentioned about how all these people are just hoping and wishing and, you know, things are going to turn out better, just in the face of absolute absence of any evidence that it will turn out better. I mean, just the depth of religion and idealism, you know, it's a statement about what kind of education happens here, why falsification has to be a part of the educational process in this country. You cannot tell the truth. Nobody learns the truth in a so-called education here. They talk about how education is a solution to everything, but, you know, like the education has to falsify in order to keep the imperialist thing going. Falsification is a profoundly, you know, like important aspect of that. And so people say, we don't know anything about African history. We don't know anything about American history. We don't know anything about anything. You don't know anything about the economy. Because a falsification is absolutely necessary for the thing to work. You got a system that requires falsification, lying, and what have you, in order for it to continue, like, to operate. And to the extent that the covers start taking over and people no longer believe in it, there is no Santa Claus, Virginia, no matter what they say, you know, and people begin to, you know, to recognize this, then, you know, the system itself is in deep, deep, deep trouble. Or as George Herbert Walker Bush might have said, deep doo-doo.
I want to, we've got just a few minutes left, and
I just want to make one other comment, comrade. That what we are looking at and have been looking at, especially in the African community for a while now, is the stuff that revolution is made of. I told you about a letter I just got from, you know, George Morgan, this brother who's 50-some-odd years old and been in prison since 1968 or something for a murder he didn't commit. But the thing is, it happens all the time, every day. And even the offenses that people are, quote-unquote, guilty of has nothing to do with the kind of sentences they get. You got Chain Gang Charlie Crist here, who reintroduced the chain gang because it was in the brains. Everybody knew chain gang was associated with torture of African people in prisons. You got some clown, I think, in one of the Carolinas, who reintroduced stripes or striped, you know, prison outfits because that's associated with Africans. You got the growing numbers of children being stuffed into prison because they're essentially designed for African children because they know what happens to those children in the prison system. It's a part of the process of demoralization. It's all torture. It's all an offense against African people, and somebody should be getting shot for it. I mean, and the reality is that it is the stuff that revolution is made of. That's why they have to continue to falsify everything. That's why they have to continue to kiss up to a Barack Obama. I'm talking now about so-called revolutionaries, about so-called nationalists and what have you. In particular, I know why the ruling class needs him, but these other clowns who've pretended to be on our side all this time and now find themselves in the camp of smack dab in the camp of imperialism because of Obama, this is the kind of stuff that they are justifying and holding up. I just think it's necessary to say that revolution is the only way out of this. We're going to have to make a revolution, overturn this rotten, filthy system that's responsible for the oppression of Africans and everybody on this earth. It's got to go. It's not a question of whether Dick Cheney agreed to torture or something like that. It's what the whole system must necessarily do in order to stay afloat and how it must keep everybody else oppressed as a condition for its existence.
Yeah, uh-huh. Right on. That sums it up.
Yes.
And about, you know, self-organization, of course, and this is the struggle that we have to make all the time. People come up to me all the time, you know, they revolutionary this and they don't belong to any organization. They certainly aren't in the party and what have you. They don't belong to the African People's Solidarity Committee. They don't belong to the African Socialist International. They're not talking about getting organized. They just, you know, revolutionaries, you know what I mean? They're people who got a good conversation at best. You know, organization, and even inside our own organization, the struggle for organization, the struggle, you know, like to make our organization do what they're supposed to do.
Yes.
Because this is not just some fraternity of people who kind of like each other, who like to wear the same clothing, etc. We're talking about changing the world and changing the future so that people can have one. So, you know, these are the profound questions that we are confronted with. And even in our own ranks, I'm doing everything I can to flush them out and kick them out because we have to make a revolution and we have to build a revolutionary capacity. We have to build organizational capacity to make that happen.
Well, we are nearing the end of the program today, and I just want to say in closing that this is Uhuru Radio. This is where you need to be. This is where you need to be listening. We do this program as part of an overall process of changing the world. We don't just come on here and talk just for the sake of talking, but it's part of a process of changing the world because we understand that in order to change the world, we have to change the ideas in the heads of our people and of the people in the world. And so this is why we do the work that we do. This is why we broadcast Uhuru Radio as a part of this process of changing the world. And I want to call on those of you out there who are listening to become a part of this process of changing the world. It's good to listen. It's great to listen. But it's better to do. It's better to be a part of the process of changing the world as opposed to sitting on the sidelines. Because the problem with sitting on the sidelines is that you when one of the sides win, you don't win with the side. So the thing is to get off the sidelines, get in the game, and let's change the world. Let's make a new kind of world. And I would call on those of you listening to become volunteers with Uhuru Radio. You have our email, dj@uhururadio.com. You can do that there. Or you can call us to do so. And we have so much to be done from, you know, programming to stapling papers. You know, there's all kind of work to be done, and you can do something. And if Uhuru Radio is not the thing that you can do, join the Uhuru movement, because the reality is there is no future unless we make it. So you have to be a part of making it. So that's it for Africa Live here on uhururadio.com. But don't worry, because we got more coming for you. We got Uhuru on the Move coming up right up behind us, hosted by Impidum President Ivory Sobukwe Sodaye and Kobina Bantu Shango. So stay tuned here on UhuruRadio.com.
Africa Live.
Saying is, ain't nobody gonna do this for us but us. Talk about a Barack Obama. Don't even talk to me about Barack Obama. Let's talk about Marcus Garvey. You know what I'm saying? The question ain't whether we vote for white power and white face or white power and black face. The question is whether we will be an independent people or whether we remain colonized and oppressed until we are wiped out. This is African internationalism in action, y'all. Y'all need to get up on this. When we say we have to have power in our own hands, here, we're talking about the African working class. What we can do is to have an organized capacity of the African workers in alliance with the poor peasants who takes state power for itself. Then we can begin to say we got justice in our own hands.
Africa Live.